Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget the bug spray as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
Hey guys, and welcome to Monsteropolis, a show about monsters, anomalies, and legends. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I was joined, as always, by my pal, Mark Matzke. Unfortunately, I accidentally deleted the beginning of the show, which I am now re-recording. The problem is, in re-recording the show, I was going to lose the opening of the story I'm reading. So a setup, this is the special Christmas episode of Monsteropolis. So Mark and I read scary Christmassy stories to you, the listeners. So I have to restart this story and make it sound like it's the original recording, which I'm botching already. Before I get into that real quickly, remember, we have an event coming up March 21st at the Canton Palace Theater called Mysteries and Monsters. We will be there. Mark and I will be there. We'll have vendors. We'll have Lyle Blackburn, Shannon LeGros, some other special guests will be in attendance. And tickets are $12. You can buy them at cantonpalace.org. And I think that does it. But yeah, this is our special Christmas episode. So happy holidays. Merry Christmas to all of you, the listeners. My story is called The Story of the Goblins Who Stole a Sexton, and it is fittingly written by Charles Dickens. And I didn't know this when I did this actual read-through. This story came out prior to the actual A Christmas Carol. So you'll notice some similarities between the two stories. It's interesting to note that this story came out prior to that one. Anyway, in an old abbey town down in this part of the country a long, long while ago, so long that the story must be a true one, because our great-grandfathers implicitly believed it, there officiated as sexton and gravedigger in the churchyard one Gabriel Grubb. It by no means follows that because a man is a sexton and constantly surrounded by the emblems of morality, therefore he should be a morose and melancholy man. Your undertakers are the merriest fellows in the world, and I once had the honor of being on intimate terms with a mute who in private life and off duty was as comical and jocose a little fellow has ever chirped out a devil-may-care song without a hitch in his memory or drained off a good stiff glass without stopping for breath. But notwithstanding these precedents to the contrary, Gabriel Grubb was an ill-conditioned, cross-gained, surly fellow, a morose and lonely man who consorted with nobody but himself and an old wicker bottle which fitted into his large, deep waistcoat pocket, and who eyed each merry face as it passed him by with such a deep scowl of malice and ill humor as it was difficult to meet without feeling something the worse for. A little before twilight, one Christmas Eve, Gabriel shouldered his spade, lighted his lantern, and betook himself towards the old churchyard, for he had got a grave to finish by next morning, and feeling very low, he thought it might raise his spirits, perhaps if he went on with his work at once. As he went his way up the ancient street, he saw the cheerful light of the blazing fires gleam through the old casements, and heard the loud laugh and the cheerful shouts of those who were assembled around them. He marked the bustling preparations for next day's cheer and smelled the numerous savory odors consequent thereupon as they steamed up from the kitchen windows in clouds. All this was gall and wormwood to the heart of Gabrielle Grubb, and when groups of children bounded out of the houses, tripped across the road, and were met before they could knock at the opposite door by half a dozen curly-headed little rascals who crowded round them as they flocked upstairs to spend the evening in their Christmas games, Gabrielle smiled grimly and crushed the handle of his spade with a firmer grasp as he thought of measles, scarlet fever, thrush, whooping cough, and a good many other sources of consolation besides. In this happy frame of mind, Gabrielle strode along, returning a short, sullen growl to the good-humored greetings of such of his neighbors as now and then passed him, until he turned into the dark lane which led to the churchyard. Now, Gabrielle, who had been looking forward to reaching the dark lane because it was... It's probably Gabriel, huh? Not Gabrielle. Gabrielle's a girl's name. My bad. Now, Gabrielle had been looking forward to reaching the dark lane because it was, generally speaking, a nice, gloomy, mournful place into which the townspeople did not much care to go except in broad daylight and when the sun was shining. Consequently, he was not a little indignant to hear a young urchin crying. Consequently, now I lost my place. I'll have to cut all this out. Consequently, he was not a little indignant to hear a young urchin roaring out some jolly song about a Merry Christmas in this very sanctuary, which had been called Coffin Lane ever since the days of the old abbey and the time of the shaven-headed monks. As Gabrielle walked on and the voice drew nearer, he found it proceeded from a small boy who was hurrying along to join one of his little parties in the old street, and who, partly to keep himself company and partly to prepare himself for the occasion, was shouting out the song at the highest pitch of his lungs. So Gabrielle waited until the boy came up and then dodged him into a corner and rapped him over the head with his lantern 5 or 6 times just to teach him to modulate his voice. And as the boy hurried away with his hand to his head, singing quite a different sort of tune, Gabrielle Grubb chuckled very heartily to himself and entered the churchyard, locking the gate behind him. He took off his coat, set down his lantern, and getting into the unfinished grave, worked at it for an hour or so with right good will. But the earth was hardened with a frost, and it was no very easy matter to break it up and shovel it out, and although there was a moon, it was a very young one, and shed little light upon the grave, which was in the shadow of the church. At any other time, these obstacles would have made Gabrielle Grubb very moody and miserable, but he was so well pleased with having stopped the small boy's singing that he took little heed of the scanty progress he had made and looked down into the grave when he had finished work for the night with grim satisfaction, murmuring as he gathered up his things. Brave lodgings for one, brave lodgings for one. A few feet of cold earth when life is done. A stone at the head, a stone at the feet, a rich juicy meal for the worms to eat. Rank grass overhead and damp clay around, brave lodgings for one, these in holy ground. Ho ho, laughed Gabrielle Grubb as he sat himself down on a flat tombstone, which was a favorite resting place of his, and drew forth his wicker bottle. A coffin at Christmas, a Christmas box, ho ho ho. Gabrielle paused in some alarm in the act of raising the wicker bottle to his lips and looked around. The bottom of the oldest grave about him was not more still and quiet than the churchyard in the pale moonlight. The cold horror frost glistened on the tombstones and sparkled like rows of gems among the stone carvings of the old church. The snow lay hard and crisp upon the ground and spread over the thickly strewn mounds of earth, so white and smooth a cover that it seemed as if corpses lay there, hidden only by their winding sheets. Not the faintest rustle broke the profound tranquility of the solemn scene. Sound itself appeared to be frozen up, all was so cold and still. It was the echoes, said Gabrielle Grubb, raising the bottle to his lips again. It was not, said a deep voice. Gabrielle started up and stood rooted to the spot with astonishment and terror, for his eyes rested on a form that made his blood run cold. Seated on an upright tombstone close to him was a strange, unearthly figure whom Gabrielle felt at once was no being of this world. His long, fantastic legs, which might have reached the ground, were cooked up and crossed after a quaint, fantastic fashion. His sinewy arms were bare, and his hands rested on his knees. On his short, round body, he wore a close covering ornamented with small sashes, a short cloak dangled at his back. The collar was cut into curious peaks, which served the goblin in lieu of ruff or neckerchief, and his shoes curled up at his toes into long points. On his head, he wore a broad-brimmed sugar-loaf hat, garnished with a single feather. The hat was covered with a white frost, and the goblin looked as if he had sat on the same tombstone very comfortably for 200 or 300 years. He was sitting perfectly still. His tongue was put out as if in derision, and he was grinning at Gabriel Grubb with such a grin as only a goblin could call up. It was not the echoes, said the goblin. Gabriel Grubb was paralyzed and could make no reply. What do you do here on Christmas Eve? Said the goblin sternly. I came to dig a grave, sir, stammered Gabriel Grubb. What man wanders among graves and churchyards on such a night as this? Cried the goblin. Gabriel Grubb! Gabriel Grubb! Screamed a wild chorus of voices that seemed to fill the churchyard. Gabriel looked fearfully round. Nothing was to be seen. What have you got in that bottle? Said the goblin. Holland, sir, replied the sexton, trembling more than ever, for he had bought it off the smugglers, and he thought that perhaps his questioner might be in the excise department of the goblins. Who drinks Holland alone and in a churchyard on such a night as this? Said the goblin. Gabriel Grubb, Gabriel Grubb, exclaimed the wild voices again. The goblin leered maliciously at the terrified sexton, and then raising his voice exclaimed, And who, then, is our fair and lawful prize? To this inquiry, the invisible chorus replied in a strain that sounded like the voices of many choristers singing to the mighty swell of the old church organ, a strain that seemed borne to the sexton's ears upon a wild wind, and to die away as it passed onward. But the burden of the reply was still the same. Gabriel Grubb, Gabriel Grubb. The goblin grinned a broader grin than before, as he said, Well, Gabriel, what do you say to this? The sexton gasped for breath. What do you think of this, Gabriel? Said the goblin, kicking up his feet in the air on either side of the tombstone and looking at the turned up points with as much complacency as if he had been contemplating the most fashionable pair of Wellingtons in all Broad Bond Street. It's very curious, sir, replied the sexton, half dead with fright. Very curious and very pretty, but I think I'll go back and finish my work, sir, if you please. Work, said the goblin. What work? The grave, sir, making the grave, stammered the sexton. Oh, the grave, eh? Said the goblin. Who makes graves at a time when all other men are merry and takes a pleasure in it? Again, the mysterious voices replied, Gabriel Grubb, Gabriel Grubb. I am afraid my friends want you, Gabriel, said the goblin, thrusting his tongue further into his cheek than ever, and a most astonishing tongue it was. I'm afraid my friends want you, Gabriel, said the goblin. Under favor, sir, replied the horror-stricken sexton. I don't think they can, sir. They don't know me, sir. I don't think the gentlemen have ever seen me. Oh, yes, they have, replied the goblin. We know the man with the sulky face and grim scowl that came down the street tonight, throwing his evil looks at the children and grasping his burying spade the tighter. We know the man who struck the boy in the envious malice of his heart because the boy could be merry and he could not. We know him. Here the goblin gave a loud, shrill laugh, which the echoes returned 20-fold, and throwing his legs up in the air, stood upon his head, or rather upon the very point of his sugar loaf hat, on the narrow edge of the tombstone, whence he threw a somerset, with extraordinary agility, right to the sexton's feet, at which he planted himself in the attitude in which tailors generally sit upon the shopboard. I am afraid I must leave, sir, said the sexton, making an effort to move. Leave us, said the goblin. Gabriel Grubb going to leave us. Ho, ho, ho. As the goblin laughed, the sexton observed for one instant a brilliant illumination within the windows of the church, as if the whole building were lighted up. It disappeared. The organ pealed forth a lively air, and the whole troop of goblins, the very counterpart of the first one, poured into the churchyard and began playing at leapfrog with the tombstones, never stopping for an instant to take breath, but overing the highest among them, one after the other, with the most marvelous dexterity. The first goblin was a most astonishing leaper, and none of the others could come near him. Even in the extremity of his terror, the sexton could not help observing that while his friends were content to leap over the common-sized gravestones, the first one took the family vaults, iron railings, and all, with as much ease as if they had been so many street posts. At last, the game reached to a most exciting pitch. The organ played quicker and quicker, and the goblins leaped faster and faster, coiling themselves up, rolling head over heels upon the ground, and the bounding over the tombstones like footballs. The sexton's brain whirled round with the rapidity of the motion he beheld, and his legs reeled beneath him as the spirits flew before his eyes. When the goblin king suddenly darted towards him, laid his hand upon his collar, and sank with him through the earth. When Gabriel Grubb had had time to fetch his breath, which the rapidity of his descent had for the moment taken away, he found himself in what appeared to be a large cavern, surrounded on all sides by crowds of goblins, ugly and grim. In the center of the room, on an elevated seat, was stationed his friend of the churchyard, and close behind him stood Gabriel Grubb himself, without power of motion. "Cold tonight?" said the king of the goblins. "Very cold. A glass of something warm here." At this command, half a dozen officious goblins with a perpetual smile upon their faces, whom Gabriel Grubb imagined to be courtiers, on that account, hastily disappeared and presently returned with a goblet of liquid fire, which they presented to the king. "Ah," cried the goblin, whose cheeks and throat were transparent as he tossed down the flame, "this warms one indeed. Bring a bumper of the same for Mr. Grubb." It was in vain for the unfortunate sexton to protest that he was not in the habit of taking anything warm at night. One of the goblins held him while another poured the blazing liquid down his throat. The whole assembly screeched with laughter as he coughed and choked and wiped away the tears which gushed plentifully from his eyes after swallowing the burning draught. "And now," said the king, fantastically poking the taper corner of his sugar loaf hat into the sexton's eye and thereby occasioning him the most exquisite pain, "and now show the man of misery and gloom a few of the pitchers from our own great storehouse." As the goblin said this, a thick cloud which obscured the remoter end of the cavern rolled gradually away and disclosed, apparently at a great distance, a small and scantily furnished but neat and clean apartment. A crowd of little children were gathered round a bright fire, clinging to their mother's gown and gambling around her chair. The mother occasionally rose and drew aside the window curtain as if to look for some expected object. A frugal meal was ready spread upon the table, and an elbow chair was placed near the fire. A knock was heard at the door. The mother opened it, and the children crowded around her and clapped their hands for joy as their father entered. He was wet and weary and shook the snow from his garments as the children crowded round him, and seizing his cloak, hat, stick, and gloves with busy zeal, ran with him from the room. Then, as he sat down at his meal before the fire, the children climbed about his knee, and the mother sat by his side, and all seemed happiness and comfort. But a change came upon the view, almost imperceptibly. The scene was altered to a small bedroom where the fairest and youngest child lay dying. The roses had fled from his cheeks and the light from his eye. And even as the sexton looked upon him with an interest he had never felt or known before, he died. His young brothers and sisters crowded round his little bed and seized his tiny hand, so cold and heavy, but they shrank back from its touch and looked with awe on his infant face, for calm and tranquil as it was, and sleeping in rest and peace as the beautiful child seemed to be, they saw that he was dead, and they knew that he was an angel looking down upon and blessing them from a bright and happy heaven. Again, the light cloud passed across the picture, and again the subject changed. The father and mother were old and helpless now, and the number of those about them was diminished more than half. But content and cheerfulness sat on every face and beamed in every eye as they crowded round the fireside and told and listened to old stories of earlier and bygone days. Slowly and peacefully, the father sank into the grave, and soon after, the sharer of all his cares and troubles followed him to a place of rest. The few who yet survived them kneeled by their tomb and watered the green turf which covered it with their tears, then rose and turned away sadly and mournfully, but not with bitter cries or despairing lamentations, for they knew that they should one day meet again, and once more they mixed with the busy world, and their content and cheerfulness were restored. The cloud settled upon the picture and concealed it from the sexton's view. "What do you think of that?" said the goblin, turning his large face towards Gabriel Grubb. Gabriel murmured out something about its being very pretty and looking somewhat ashamed as the goblin bent his fiery eyes upon him. "You miserable man," said the goblin in a tone of excessive contempt. "You!" He appeared disposed to add more, but indignation choked his utterance, so he lifted up one of his very pliable legs and, flourishing it above his head a little to ensure his aim, administered a good sound kick to Gabriel Grubb, immediately after which all the goblins in waiting crowded round the wretched sexton and kicked him without mercy, according to the established and invariable custom of courtiers upon earth who kick whom royalty kicks and hug whom royalty hugs. "Show him some more," said the king of the goblins. At these words, the cloud was dispelled and a rich and beautiful landscape was disclosed to view. There's just such another to this day within half a mile of the old abbey town. The sun shone from out the clear blue sky, and the water sparkled beneath his rays, and the trees looked greener and like flowers more gay beneath its cheering influence. The water rippled on with a pleasant sound, the trees rustled in the light wind that murmured among their leaves, the birds sang upon the boughs, and the lark caroled on high her welcome to the morning. Yes, it was morning, the bright balmy morning of summer. The minutest leaf, the smallest blade of grass, was instinct with life. The ant crept forth to her daily toil, the butterfly fluttered and basked in the warm rays of the sun. Myriads of insects spread their transparent wings and reveled in their brief but happy existence. Man walked forth, elated with the scene, and all was brightness and splendor. "You, a miserable man," said the king of the goblins in a more contemptuous tone than before. And again the king of the goblins gave his leg a flourish. Again it descended on the shoulders of the sexton, and again the attendant goblins imitated the example of their chief. Many a time the cloud went and came, and many a lesson it taught to Gabriel Grubb, who, although his shoulders smarted with pain from the frequent applications of the goblin's feet, looked on with an interest that could not diminish. He saw that men who worked hard and earned their scanty bread with lives of labor were cheerful and happy, and that to the most ignorant, the sweet face of nature was a never-failing source of cheerfulness and joy. He saw those who had been delicately nurtured and tenderly brought up, cheerful under privations and superior to suffering, that would have crushed many of a rougher grain, because they bore within their own bosoms the materials of happiness, contentment, and peace. He saw that woman, the tenderest and most fragile of all God's creatures, were the oftenest superior to sorrow, adversity, and distress. And he saw that it was because they bore in their own hearts an inexhaustible wellspring of affection and devotion. Above all, he saw that men like himself, who snarled at the mirth and cheerfulness of others, were the foulest weeds on the fair surface of the earth. And setting all the good of the world against the evil, he came to the conclusion that it was a very decent and respectable sort of world after all. No sooner had he formed it than the cloud which had closed over the last picture seemed to settle on his senses and lull him to repose. One by one, the goblins faded from his sight, and as the last one disappeared, he sank to sleep. The day had broken when Gabriel Grubb awoke and found himself lying at full length on a flat gravestone in the churchyard, with a wicker bottle lying empty by his side and his coat, spade, and lantern all well whitened by the late night frost scattered on the ground. The stone on which he had first seen the goblin seated stood bolt upright before him, and the grave at which he had worked the night before was not far off. At first, he began to doubt the reality of his adventures, but the acute pain in his shoulders when he attempted to rise assured him that the kicking of the goblins was certainly not ideal. He was staggered again by observing no traces of footsteps in the snow on which the goblins had played at leapfrog with the gravestones, but he speedily accounted for this circumstance when he remembered that, being spirits, they would leave no visible impression behind them. So Gabriel Grubb got on his feet as well as he could for the pain in his back and brushing the frost off his coat, put it on, and turned his face toward the town. But he was an altered man, and he could not bear the thought of returning to a place where his repentance would be scoffed at and his reformation disbelieved. He hesitated for a few moments and then turned away to wander where he might and seek his bread elsewhere. The lantern, the spade, and the wicker bottle were found that day in the churchyard. There were a great many speculations about the sexton's fate at first, but it was speedily determined that he had been carried away by the goblins, and there were not wanting some very credible witnesses who had distinctly seen him whisk through the air on the back of a chestnut horse, blind of one eye, with the hindquarters of a lion and the tail of a bear. At length, all this was devoutly believed, and the new sexton used to exhibit to the curious, for a trifling emolument, a good-sized piece of the church weathercock which had been accidentally kicked off by the aforesaid horse in his aerial flight and picked up by himself in the churchyard a year or two afterwards. Unfortunately, these stories were somewhat disturbed by the unlooked-for reappearance of Gabriel Grubb himself some 10 years afterwards, a ragged, contented, rheumatic old man. He told his story to the clergyman and also to the mayor, and in course of time it began to be received as a matter of history, in which form it has continued down to this very day. The believers in the weather cocktail, having misplaced their confidence once, were not easily prevailed upon to part with it again. So they looked as wise as they could, shrugged their shoulders, touched their foreheads, and murmured something about Gabriel Grubb having drunk all the Hollands and then fallen asleep on the flat tombstone. And they affected to explain what he supposed he had witnessed in the Goblin's Cavern by saying that he had seen the world and grown wiser. But this opinion, which was by no means a popular one at any time, gradually died off. And be the matter how it may, as Gabriel Grubb was afflicted with rheumatism to the end of his days, this story has at least one moral, if it teach no one better, and that is that if a man turns sulky and drunk by himself at Christmas time, he may make up his mind to be not a bit the better for it. Let the spirits be never so good, or let them be even as many degrees beyond proof as those which Gabriel Grubb saw in the Goblin's Cavern. That was a pretty good one.
That's awesome, yeah.
I like that. It's kind of like the Christmas Carol.
It is. There's parallels there, yeah. For sure.
I'd be curious. I'm assuming Christmas Carol came first, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Don't know. It's an interesting... It's like, in some ways, it's anti-Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
But it's... Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah.
Very good. Well...
This will be our longest episode in history.
It may be that, yes. All right. The story I've selected for our... late night Christmas Eve consideration is by M.R. James, and it's called A School Story. Two men in a smoking room were talking of their private school days. At our school, said A, we had a ghost's footmark on the staircase. What was it like? Oh, very unconvincing. Just the shape of a shoe with a square toe, if I remember right. The staircase was a stone one. I never heard any story about the thing. That seems odd when you come to think of it. Why didn't somebody invent one, I wonder? You never can tell with little boys. They have a mythology of their own. There's a subject for you, by the way. The folklore of private schools. Yes, the crop is rather scanty, though. I imagine if you were to investigate the cycle of ghost stories, for instance, which the boys at private schools tell each other, they would all turn out to be highly compressed versions of stories out of books. Nowadays, the Strand and Pearsons and so on would be extensively drawn upon. No doubt. They weren't born or thought of in my time. Let's see. I wonder if I can remember the staple ones that I was told. First, there was the house with a room in which a series of people insisted on passing a night, and each of them in the morning was found kneeling in a corner and had just time to say, "I've seen it," and died. Wasn't that the house in Berkeley Square? I dare say it was. Then there was the man who heard a noise in the passage at night, opened his door, and saw someone crawling towards him on all fours, with his eye dangling out on his cheek. There was, besides, let me think. Yes, the room where a man was found dead in bed with a horseshoe mark on his forehead, and the floor under the bed was covered with marks of horseshoes also. I don't know why. Also, there was the lady who, on locking her bedroom door in a strange house, heard a thin voice among the bed curtains say, "Now we're shut in for the night." None of these had any explanation or sequel. I wonder if they still go on, those stories. Oh, likely enough, with additions from the magazines, as I said. You never heard, did you, of a real ghost at a private school? I thought not. Nobody has that ever I came across. From the way in which you said that, I gather that you have. I really don't know. But this is what was in my mind. It happened at my private school 30-odd years ago, and I haven't any explanation of it. The school, I mean, was near London. It was established in a large and fairly old house, a great white building with very fine grounds about it. There were large cedars in the garden, as there are in so many of the older gardens in the Thames Valley, and ancient elms in the three or four fields which we used for our games. I think it probably was quite an attractive place, but boys seldom allow that their schools possess any tolerable features. I came to the school in a September, soon after the year 1870, and among the boys who arrived on the same day was one whom I took to, a Highland boy whom I will call MacLeod. I needn't spend time in describing him. The main thing is that I got to know him very well. He was not an exceptional boy in any way, not particularly good at books or games, but he suited me. The school was a large one. There must have been from 100, 120 to 130 boys there as a rule. so a considerable staff of masters was required, and there were rather frequent changes among them. One term, perhaps it was my third or fourth, a new master made his appearance. His name was Samson. He was a tallish, stoutish, pale, black-bearded man. I think we liked him. He had traveled a good deal and had stories which amused us on our school walks, so that there was some competition among us to get within earshot of him. I remember, too, dear me, I've hardly thought of it since then, that he had a charm on his watch chain that attracted my attention one day, and he let me examine it. It was, I now suppose, a gold Byzantine coin. There was an effigy of some absurd emperor on one side. The other side had been worn practically smooth, and he had cut on it, rather barbarously, his own initials, GWS, and a date, 24 July, 1865. Yes, I can see it now. He had told me he had picked it up in Constantinople. It was about the size of a florin, perhaps rather smaller. Well, the first odd thing that happened was this. Samson was doing Latin grammar with us. One of his favorite methods, perhaps it is a rather good one, was to make us construct sentences out of our own heads to illustrate the rules he was trying to make us learn. Of course, that is a thing which gives a silly boy a chance of being impertinent. There are lots of school stories in which that happens. Or anyhow, there might be. But Samson was too good a disciplinarian for us to think of trying that with him. Now, on this occasion, he was telling us how to express remembering in Latin. He ordered us each to make a sentence beginning with the verb memini, I remember. Well, most of us made up some ordinary sentence, such as I remember my father, or he remembers his book, or something equally uninteresting. And I dare say a good many put down memino librum meum, and so forth. But the boy I mentioned, McLeod, was evidently thinking of something more elaborate than that. The rest of us wanted to have our sentences passed and get on to something else, so some kicked him under the desk, and I, who was next to him, poked him and whispered to him to look sharp, but he didn't seem to attend. I looked at his paper and saw that he had put down nothing at all, so I jogged him again harder than before and upbraided him sharply for keeping us all waiting. That did have some effect. He started and seemed to wake up, and then very quickly he scribbled about a couple of lines on his paper and showed it up with the rest. As it was the last, or nearly the last, to come in, and as Samson had a good deal to say to the boys who had written Meminiscus Patri Meo and the rest of it, it turned out that the clock struck 12 before he had got to McLeod, and McLeod had to wait afterwards to have his sentence corrected. There was nothing much going on outside when I got out, so I waited for him to come. He came very slowly when he did arrive, and I guessed there had been some sort of trouble. Well, I said, what did you get? Oh, I don't know, said McLeod, nothing much. But I think Samson's rather sick with me. Why, did you show him up some rot? No fear, he said. It was all right as far as I could see. It was like this. Memento, that's right enough for remember, and it takes a genitive. Memento pute inter quatuor taxos. What silly rot, I said. What made you shove that down? What does it mean? That's the funny part, said McLeod. I'm not quite sure what it does mean. All I know is it just came into my head and I corked it down. I know what I think it means, because just before I wrote it down, I had sort of a picture of it in my head. I believe it means, remember the well among the four. And what are those dark sort of trees that have red berries on them? Mountain ashes, I suppose you mean. I never heard of them, said McLeod. No, I'll tell you. Yews. Well, and what did Samson say? Why, he was jolly odd about it. When he read it, he got up and went to the mantelpiece and stopped quite a long time without saying anything, with his back to me. And then he said, without turning round and rather quiet, what do you suppose that means? I told him what I thought, only I couldn't remember the name of the silly tree. And then he wanted to know why I had put it down, and I had to say something or other, and after he left off talking about it and asked me how long I'd been here and where my people lived and things like that, and then I came away, but he wasn't looking a bit well. I don't remember any more that was said by either of us about this. Next day, McLeod took to his bed with a chill or something of the kind, and it was a week or more before he was in school again. And as much as a month went by without anything happening that was noticeable. Whether or not Mr. Samson was really startled as McLeod had thought, he didn't show it. I am pretty sure, of course, now that there was something very curious in his past history, but I'm not going to pretend that we boys were sharp enough to guess any such thing. There was one other incident of the same kind as the last which I told you. Several times since that day, we had had to make up examples in school to illustrate different rules, but there had never been any row except when we did them wrong. At last there came a day when we were going through those dismal things which people called conditional sentences, and we were told to make a conditional sentence expressing a future consequence. We did it, right or wrong, and showed up our bits of paper, and Samson began looking through them. All at once he got up, made some odd sort of noise in his throat, and rushed out by a door that was just by his desk. We sat there for a minute or two, and then, I suppose it was incorrect, but we went up, I and one or two others, to look at the papers on his desk. Of course, I thought someone must have put down some nonsense or other, and Samson had gone off to report him. All the same, I noticed that he hadn't taken any of the papers with him when he ran out. Well, the top paper on the desk was written in red ink, which no one used, and it wasn't in anyone's hand who was in the class. They all looked at it, McLeod and all, and took their dying oaths that it wasn't theirs. Then I thought of counting the bits of paper, and of this I made quite certain that there were 17 bits of paper on the desk and 16 boys in the form. Well, I bagged the extra paper and kept it, and I believe I have it now. And now you will want to know what was written on it. It was simple enough, and harmless enough, I should have said. Si tu non verinis ad me, ego veniam ad te, which means, I suppose, if you don't come to me, I'll come to you. Could you show me the paper? Interrupted the listener. Yes, I could, but there's another odd thing about it. That same afternoon, I took it out of my locker. I know for certain it was the same bit, for I made a finger mark on it, and no single trace of writing of any kind was there on it. I kept it, as I said, and since that time I've tried various experiments to see whether sympathetic ink had been used, but absolutely without result. And so much for that. After about half an hour, Samson looked in again, said he had felt very unwell, and told us we might go. He came rather gingerly to his desk and gave just one look at the uppermost paper, and I suppose he thought he must have been dreaming. Anyhow, he asked no questions. That day was a half holiday, and next day Samson was in school again, much as usual. That night, the third and last incident in my story happened. We, McLeod and I, slept in a dormitory at right angles to the main building. Samson slept in the main building on the first floor. There was a very bright full moon, at an hour which I can't tell exactly, but sometime between 1 and 2, I was woken up by somebody shaking me. It was McLeod, and a nice state of mind he seemed to be in. Come, he said, come, there's a burglar getting in through Samson's window. As soon as I could speak, I said, well, why not call out and wake everybody up? No, no, he said, I'm not sure who it is. Don't make a row, come and look. Naturally, I came and looked, and naturally, there was no one there. I was cross enough. I should have called McLeod plenty of names, only I couldn't tell why. It seemed to me that there was something wrong, something that made me very glad I wasn't alone to face it. We were still at the window looking out, and as soon as I could, I asked him what he had heard or seen. I didn't hear anything at all, he said, but about 5 minutes before I woke you, I found myself looking out of this window here, and there was a man sitting or kneeling on Samson's windowsill and looking in, and I thought he was beckoning. What sort of man? McLeod wriggled. I don't know, he said, but I can tell you one thing. He was beastly thin, and he looked as if he was wet all over. And he said, looking round and whispering as if he hardly liked to hear himself, I'm not at all sure that he was alive. He went on talking in whispers some time longer and eventually crept back to bed. No one else in the room woke or stirred the whole time. I believe we did sleep a bit afterwards, but we were very cheap next day. And next day, Mr. Samson was gone, not to be found, and I believe no trace of him has ever come to light since. In thinking it over, one of the oddest things about it has seemed to me to be the fact that neither McLeod nor I ever mentioned what we had seen to any third person whatever. Of course, no questions were asked on the subject, and if they had been, I'm inclined to believe that we would not have made any answer. We seemed unable to speak about it. That's my story, said the narrator. The only approach to a ghost story connected with the school that I know, but still I think an approach to such a thing. The sequel to this may perhaps be reckoned highly conventional, but a sequel there is, and so it must be produced. There had been more than one listener to this story, and in the latter part of the same year, or of the next, one such listener was staying at a country house in Ireland. One evening, his host was turning over a drawer of odds and ends in the smoking room, and suddenly put his hand upon a little box. "Now," he said, "you know about old things. Tell me what that is." My friend opened the little box and found in it a thin gold chain with an object attached to it. He glanced at the object and then took off his spectacles to examine it more narrowly. "What's the history of this?" he asked. "Odd enough," was the answer. "You know the yew thicket in the shrubbery? Well, a year or two back we were cleaning out the old well that used to be in the clearing here, and what do you suppose we found?" "Is it possible that you found a body?" said the visitor with an odd feeling of nervousness. "We did that. But what's more, in every sense of the word, we found two." "Good heavens, two? Was there anything to show how they got there? Was this thing found with them?" "It was. Amongst the rags of the clothes that were on one of the bodies, a bad business, whatever the story of it may have been. One body had the arms tight round the other. They must have been there 30 years or more, long enough before we came to this place. You may judge, we filled the well up fast enough. Do you make anything of what's cut on that gold coin you have there?" "I think I can," said my friend, holding it to the light, but he read it without much difficulty. "It seems to be GWS, 24 July, 1865.
What was that one called again?
A school story.
What is M.R. James? That name is familiar to me. Why do I know that name?
We brought him up last time.
Okay.
He has one, I think one of his most famous stories is about an etching that of a house or something.
Okay.
It's something with tint in the title.
All right.
But he's very well known in terms of those type of ghost stories. Very prolific.
Cool. I like that one a lot. All right, so that does it for our second annual Christmas Spooky Stories readings. Thank you if you hung through this with us. Mark did wonderful. I stammered my way through as always. We will be back, possibly not next week, the week of Christmas, but the week after, hopefully. And I think that does it for now. Send us mail, monsteropolismail@gmail.com. Leave us ratings and reviews on iTunes. Any final thoughts on this topic of spooky stories, Christmas, any?
Just cover up.
Yeah, beware.
Stay warm.
Beware.
And Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Yeah.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com. It is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.